direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
Oh my God, that's me. All right. How's the hair? He has a pay. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Billy Masters Live. Oh, it's a little bump here. Well, you know, yeah, maybe I have a tumor. Anyway, welcome to Billy Masters Live. I am, of course, your host, Billy Masters. Who the fuck else would I be? And today is, thank you, Monica, Thursday, April 22nd, 2021. Oh, my God. So can I just tell you, I am still in Boston during this endless quarantine. And, you know, 2 days ago, it was 70 degrees. Right now, according to my phone, it is 32 degrees. It's madness. I cannot stand it. So that's why I'm in a sweater. I put all my sweaters away, and then I woke up freezing, and I said, oh, I have to get a sweater. You know, can I just tell you, speaking of waking up, so this morning, it was like 7 in the morning, I got a text from somebody, this really cute guy, by the way, and I got to put the glasses on because I cannot see anything. Oh, I've got new glasses. Kenny. So these are the glasses that I love because they're just pale and they, but then I got these ones. Ooh, look at that. I think they're too dark on top. Anyway. Okay. Anyway, this guy texted me. I know it was 2:40 in the morning. OMG, did I just see you on a Real Housewives of Atlanta rerun? Okay. I will never live this down. Of course, I also keep showing the clip. But yes, it is the gift that keeps on giving. You know, those residuals come in handy when you need to, like, buy. If you want to supersize a meal at McDonald's, get on a Real Housewives, because those residuals really come in handy when they say, would you like to go large? And then you look and say, yes, I can afford that. So I'm not going to show the clip. I've shown the clip a million times. But here's what happened. I was hosting the white carpet at the white party, I don't know how many years ago, 6. And, oh God, that the big one, the big blonde one, whatever the hell her name is. The one that had slept with Tracy Young. So anyway, they had been trying. So this is, there's a great show. Oh, I'm all over the place today. There's a great show on E! That Andy Cohen, you know, with the eye, he's hosting this show, and the reality about reality TV or something like that. Anyway, he's going behind the scenes of reality TV, but he's not going to go behind the scenes of The Real Housewives because that's his show. But I'm going to tell you. So, whatever the hell that woman's name was, somebody will text me what the woman who I talked to on The Real Housewives was. The big blonde who looks like she might have been a man at some point. Anyway, so she had slept with Tracy Young. She had had a relationship with DJ Tracy Young. And The Real Housewives producers has been trying to figure out a way to get this into the show. This is how I realized how reality TV works. And they couldn't find a way. So they came up to me and they said, have you heard the rumors about Kim Zolciak? That's her name. They said, have you heard the rumors about Kim and Tracy Young? And I said, yes, of course. They said, well, you should ask her about that because nobody's asked her about that yet. And that would be a scoop for you. And this is how they really got me. They said, and you know, you might become a regular on the show as like our go-to gossip columnist. So I'm like, oh my God, Bravo money. I could get supersize my meal every week. So anyway, so I asked Kim, and of course, Kim didn't like it, and then she complained about me and whatever. But it was a really funny moment, and I looked really cute. And so, but every once in a while, it comes up, and people ask me, how did it all happen? It was all manufactured, because I was supposed to greet her and welcome her to the white party and, you know, have a good time. And next thing you know, I'm on the show. So if a producer asks you to do something, do it. That's my advice. Okay, let me tell you what happened with today's show, because our guest is backstage and I want him to know how this all, because it was, first off, I owe him a debt of gratitude. So I had been wanting to talk to Eric Neese and Norm Corpy, who are both friends of mine, who were on the Real World New York, the first season of The Real World. And then they just did this reunion series, which was fabulous. I cried every episode. And I wanted to have them on to talk about their experience on the show 30 years ago and now. It's really 29 years. So Norm had said to me, and I wanted to talk to them when the show began. Norm said to me, you should wait until the series is over because there's going to be a lot that comes out that you are going to want to talk about, which he was right, by the way. So Norm and Eric were supposed to be on last week. And Eric texted me and said, I'm going to Peru. Because, like, he's a spiritual healer and a guide, and that's what you do in Peru on an alpaca, probably. And so he said, could we do it next week? Because last Thursday he was traveling, and he said, but I can do it next week. I said, sure. So we had Richard Meinards and we did Royals. So this week, like, Tuesday, Del will remember, I think it was Tuesday, I got a text from Eric saying, I have really crappy internet down here in Peru, and I may not be able to do it. Could we switch it to next week? Well, I had somebody else for next week, but I said, sure, I can switch it around. Then that person said to me, I said, well, I can't do this week. And Eric wasn't telling me definitely yes or no. So I reached out to Del Shores, and I said, you know, I've wanted you on the show for a while. Could you do this week or next week? I really don't know which week is going to be free. And he was lovely. And he said, whatever you need, Billy. So then I didn't hear from Eric. Now, I hope he's okay. He might have fell into some ravine or volcano or something, whatever they have in Peru. So I said to Del, look, I haven't heard from him. So let's just take care of this week. So that's how this all came about. So I don't know who's on next week. I hope it's Eric and Norm, but I might have to find somebody else. So before I bring out the guest, I just want to acknowledge the passing that just happened yesterday. Okay, you're not going to know this person. Tempest Storm. Now, Tempest Storm was one of the last surviving women who was in burlesque. She was a stripper, but, like, she really didn't show a lot. It was like that Gypsy Rose Lee kind of da-da-da-da, boom. So she passed away yesterday or the day before, and we had been talking about having her on the show. There's a great documentary about Tempest Storm that somebody just finally posted on YouTube yesterday in tribute to her. Please check it out. When you see the footage of her falling at 83, because she's trying to take her bra off and dance, and you know, you're 83. Look, I can't take my bra off and dance without falling. So I don't fall Tempest, but we've got it on film. But she was lovely. I loved her. And the documentary's really good. So definitely check it out. But anyway, Tempest Storm, she's not going to be on this show. If I ask you to be on this show, there's a good chance you won't make it. Although, Ed Asner. All right, today's guest, this is such a selfish show. Can I just say this is a selfish show? Because Del Shores and I both live in LA. We travel in the same circles. We're gay guys. He's clearly more successful than me. But he is an author, a playwright, an actor, a comedian, a director, a producer. I mean, there's not enough hyphenates for him. And we know all of the same people and we run into each other. And yet in the 22 years I've lived in LA, we have never, ever sat down and had an actual discussion. The longest discussion, Del, I don't know if you'll remember this. Kenny Morse, if you're watching, tell me what this was. There was a a memorial service at the Wallace Theater in Beverly Hills that we all went to. And you and I, for the longest conversation we've ever had, was outside at that memorial service. It wasn't Debbie Reynolds. Who the hell? Well, anyway, I'll ask him. Anyway, I am honored just to basically have a conversation with him. So if you guys enjoy this, great, eavesdrop, because I have a million questions I want to ask our guest, Del Shores.
Hey, Billy.
Hey, Del.
My mind.
Whose funeral was it?
I think it was Ron Links, the director. No,
it might have been. I don't know.
Did you go to Ron Links Memorial?
I did. I go to a lot of memorial services, like you do. But
I think it was because I remember Carol Cook spoke at that one, and
Cook spoke. That's true. I remember Carol because I remember. I think we were talking to her in the lobby. Maybe it was.
Yes, I think that was it because I remember Carol said she goes good. God, that sissy could dress up, crash, and call it theater.
And by the way, Carol and I have been talking about getting on the show. She's in the middle of a move, believe
it
or not.
Yeah, I just talked to her a couple of days ago. She's
And she and Tom are just so dear to me. And she's had some issues this past year. So she's been like, can we get to it? Can we get to it? She's like, look, I don't even know how to do this. So let me unpack first. Yeah. But she's another one. The last of that group of people who when I moved to L.A., I was looking for that Hollywood. And I didn't realize that Hollywood had died out. But she is one of the last survivors.
And 97. And her mind is still so sharp
and so funny.
Yeah, I was so happy that I got to work with her again because I worked with her in 93 and she was in my play Daughters of the Lone Star State that Ron Link directed.
And oh wow.
And then she came back and did Nolita's Mother in A Very Sordid Wedding, which was just thrilling that we got her up. She and Tom came up to Winnipeg, Canada.
Oh my
God! At their age, yes, and she was flawless. I mean, it was crazy because I've worked with a lot of people who are of a certain age, and they don't all remember their lines, but not Carol Cook. She remembers all of hers, and she gives you a couple of extra.
Well, what I love about her is that she is really the epitome of a pro, and there aren't a lot of the. You know, today there are a lot of people, a pro and a star, and you seem to have. One or the other today. You don't really get a lot of combinations.
Yeah, that's that old school where the work ethic is so important, and it is to Carol. But I was trying to think when I saw you last, because you're right, we haven't ever just like hung out.
Well, I can tell you where I saw you last, because the last thing I saw in L.A. was This Side of Crazy.
I was going to say, I saw you opening night at This Side.
Opening night, I was sitting like across the aisle from Beau Bridges, and I'm friends with Bobby Eakes. So I had gone to see that.
Well,
and
that
it was
Valentine's Day. You saw it February 14th, because I remember going up to Beau and Wendy, and I said,
"Yeah,
fuck, it's Valentine's Day, and you come see this. I mean, this is not.
Well, that's right. I couldn't make it opening night. I went on Valentine's Day, right? And and Bo was sitting across from me, and I'm like, I thought the same thing. This is not really Valentine's Day, but.
Yeah, it was. That was a wild ride.
I say it was my favorite of your plays, and I've seen practically everything you've done. But what was so interesting about that play was that everything about it was completely unexpected. And I am not usually surprised. Like sometimes theater will surprise me. Sometimes I end up knowing too much, which I really don't like to know. I really like to come in fresh. I knew I had gotten the press release and I had read like a little bit and I knew what I was getting, but it was so smart and deep. But funny, but dramatic, and also a big cast. How many people were in that? Seven?
Four. No. There's four. It was the three sisters and the
mother. But then there was the body that.
Well, yes, there was that fucked up. the man in the coma that she was having carnal relations with at the beginning of the play. I loved that play. I love that play. Samuel French just published it, so I think it's going to have a lot more productions. And you saw it in February, and that was the last time I got to direct because I literally the play closed March the 8th or March the 7th, I believe. Got on a plane March 8th to go start rehearsal in Dallas March 9th, and you know how that turned out. I mean,
It was.
three cities were announced. Didn't you do it north somewhere?
We did it in San Francisco. It did really well. That's where the premiere was, at New Conservatory Theater Center.
Oh, with great theater.
Amazing Ed Decker, artistic director. I love that theater. They've done many, many of my plays. But that was my first time to direct in that theater. So, but it's all coming back, Billy. I just got the news that they're, you know, because A Very Sordid Wedding, I adapted the stage, and it was premiering in Dallas at Uptown Players in last August. And of course, that went away. This Side of Crazy Dallas went away, but we are going to open late September. A Very Sordid.
Oh, great!
Yeah, A Very
Sordid. Oh, we have a commentary from David Rothmuller. Another Valentine's Day story. Del performed our wedding ceremony in Palm Springs. Hey, David.
Hey, David. It's good to see you. I'm glad that y'all are still together. I don't always keep people with luck. But yeah, that was fun. Debbie Holiday performed at their wedding. I plugged the show during the ceremony, you know, like a good artist would.
well, I have so many questions.
I think it was the movie. Southern Baptist Sissies was playing at the Camelot when I did their ceremony.
Oh, really?
So I managed to somehow slip in. Oh, and I've got a movie.
While you're here. Yeah. You grew up in Texas, and what I know about you is that your mom was a really strong influence on your artistic development.
Yeah, huge. My dad was a Southern Baptist preacher, and so quite frankly, he had a very big influence in my artistic development.
He certainly gave you lots of fodder for material.
You know, Billy, one of my favorite, except one time when I won, I think it was the Garland Award for Southern Baptist Sissies, I said, I want to thank Jesus Christ for giving me people to write about. and some woman came up to me after. She said, I did not like your comment. And I said, well, you know what? I'm so not sorry. But my mother was the high school drama teacher. And mm-hmm. so, you know, if you look at, you know, if I go up there, all these playbooks, mm-hmm. they're all over my house. My mother, at a very young age for me, she was paying my brother and myself $1 to either read a play or a book. And I started reading voraciously and fell in love with the theater through text originally. And then, of course, the baby, my mother went to college when we were already in grade school. And so a babysitter, literally, we would get out of school and we would take our little, you know, we were like, you know, first and third grade. And we would walk to the college and sit in the theater, do our homework on the theater seats, and then watch the rehearsal. And that's where I fell in love with theater. And
well, but how great, what a wonderful experience for somebody who turned out to be a theater kid.
Yeah, it was truly, you know, falling in love. And of course, they were doing musicals. So, you know, this little gay boy, you know, at that point, I didn't know that or anything. But, you know,
Did your brother respond to it as well?
My brother was a very good actor. My brother became also a minister. So he kind of acted. In a way, but he was an amazing actor. We were in plays together in high school. But we went very different ways in life. Very different. But my mother, I said it in my play, Six Characters in Search of a Play, which was my one mm-hmm. man show. And I did, number three was Lorraine, my mother. And I said she was the single biggest influence on my life and my career. And, you know, to this day, I think of all she taught and the things that the story she told.
You know, what I find with people who are multi-hyphenates like you is that it comes out of two things. First, resourcefulness, but secondly, necessity. And I don't know if this is true with you, but it seems to me that the writing sort of came out of wanting stuff to perform or wanting to create. And if you don't have the opportunity, you write your own.
You know what? I teach that all the time because I'm very fortunate that my mother was an educator. And later in my life, I had the opportunity to do the same. I teach every year at Northwestern State University, Louisiana.
Oh, wow.
I teach playwriting and acting. And mm-hmm. I tell all my actors, I go, you know, you can't just wait for someone to hand you the opportunity. I never did wait. And when I came out here as an actor, and I started studying with Joan Darling, who was an amazing, amazing drama coach. And I started writing scenes for my scene partner and myself. And Joan would always go, she goes, "Del, what's that from?" And I go, "Oh, I love that." She was one of three educators in my life who took me aside and said, "You're a really good writer." And so because of that, I wrote a showcase for all of my friends and myself. And I wrote these two scenes that were set in Lowaki, Texas. And I was in one of them. I played Clarence Hopkins. And then I just, after it was over, I don't know about you, but I often think that sometimes rejection, when there's something that comes into our life that feels like rejection, it's just a little bit of redirection. And for me, I was on Days of Our Lives. I was doing this tiny role. I was the bartender in Shenanigans. And one day I had a scene, a good scene with Calliope, with Arlene Sorkin. And by the afternoon, they had cut it for time reasons. And the director was so kind to me. He came over and he goes, "Oh, Del, you're such a good actor. We're going to write you something else, but this is, we don't have time for this scene. And it doesn't really advance the story, blah, blah." I went home and I took those two scenes from that showcase and I wrote a play called Cheatin' so I could be in it. And that's how it started with me writing. And while I was writing that play, while I was performing in that play, my grandfather was having these progressive strokes and all of this feuding was going on with my mother and my aunts. And I would tell these hysterical stories about my crazy family in Texas. And my director, Sherry Landrum, she said, "That's your next play." And so I wrote Daddy's Dying, Who's Got Daddy's. The Way.
And it, you know, I wonder, is your multi-talentedness, did it stop progress like in the acting career? If you couldn't write, would you have found a way to become a more successful actor, or is the divergence sort of shift your focus?
I don't know, but if you go down that path, it will just fuck you up. what if I hadn't done this? What if I hadn't done this? I will admit something to you, and I don't admit this very often. There was a period of my life after Daddy's Dying, where Daddy's Dying became so successful as a play, and then it became a movie, and then I got a deal with Warner Brothers, and my life was just spiraling in a direction that I hadn't planned.
Well, how could you?
No, wait, I'm an actor. wait, I can't do this. And then I realized after I calmed down and the checks started coming in, you know, because the checks are good. And as an actor, it was a lot of struggle. I realized that my creative mojo, if you will, was being fulfilled. I loved writing. And I didn't get to act as much, but I would act through my characters as I wrote. And then the resting came as an extension of the writing. And then full circle, I started performing again. So I'm okay with it all.
Is it as fulfilling as acting, or is it just a different kind of fulfillment?
I think it's more for me.
Really?
I do. I feel like that writing something and having it on the page and then directing it and seeing it come to life as you saw this side of crazy. It's a magical experience for me. And I mean, I've been lucky to do television, film, and theater, but if they said, "Okay, Del, you get to choose one," I would say I would want to direct my own material in the theater.
Right.
I just love it. I love that liveness. I love working with actors. And that was, boy, I miss it. I miss it so much.
Because I
don't know about you. I mean, you're stuck in Boston and I'm here in the Hollywood Hills. And I did not expect this, as nobody did. And I'm returning to the theater. I've got two plays, my third production, and then screech. And what are you doing?
Well, you know, it's funny. I thought when the pandemic began, first off, I don't think any of us thought we'd be here over a year later, still sitting at home. But I thought to myself, oh, this is great. I was telling Del backstage that I had planned on being out of commission for at least a month because I had had rotator cuff surgery. And I thought, I have all these writing projects that I want to get to, and I will use this time so effectively. And nothing has gotten done. How productive have you been during the pandemic?
I've been very productive.
I hate you.
I'm so sorry, but here was my trick. You know, Emerson Collins, who we do a show together on Tuesday, uh-huh. He's just like this on StreamYard. And there was an idea that I had, and we talked about it, and I said, write this with me. Let's do this. And we started writing, and we sold a series during the pandemic. So we can't really talk that much about the content or anything yet, but it is going forward. We're really excited about it right now. We're in development, and so we have written. I mean, we're writing like our sixth episode right now, and I have been able to do that. But I'm not sure I could have done it without Emerson. You know.
Well, that's an interesting question, because you usually work alone. Does a colleague spur you to more action?
I do like a schedule, and so knowing that I was writing with him every day from 11 to 1-ish,
that it forces you.
It forced me, and then I, in the morning. And then what I also did during the pandemic is I had a novel called The Sordid Saga, which was a prequel to Sordid Lives, the play and the film. And mm-hmm. I'd written about 18, 20 chapters and sold the series. So a lot of that material was in the series, and I just put it aside. Well, during the pandemic, I started reading those chapters live, and everybody was responding to them. So guess what? I finished the novel. I have a novel coming out. So
let's see. You've got a novel, a series. Have you written any more plays while you've been sitting home?
I have not.
Oh, thank God.
But I was commissioned to write a series of one acts for the university where I teach. So I'm going to be doing that right after we hang up here. Right after we get off, I'm just going to write a couple of plays. But I don't know. It keeps me sane, Billy. I mean, you know, or sane-ish. I don't think I've ever been sane.
Well, it gives you some normalcy. And as you said, when I started the show, it was just basically, because I still have my column every week, so there's always a few days a week I have to work on that. And I am not an altruistic person on any level, but I had seen what Seth Rudetsky and James Wesley are doing for the Actors Fund. And they were doing two shows a day, which I think is madness. Yeah. And this was at the very first week. And I texted Seth and I said, it's so great that you're doing this. And he said, well, why aren't you doing something? We have to do something to just keep people entertained and amused, because they can't watch the news every day. And I said, all right, because I was kind of guilted into it. I said, all right, I'll do that. And what happened was I found that it was actually saving me, because it gave me something to do.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I now have a little bit, not much of a different feeling, but a little bit of a different feeling about public service. Mm-hmm. That I think when you help others, it does help you. I'm still a selfish person.
No, I so agree with you. What business are we in? We're all selfish. You know, it's like someone said, do you like being recognized? I said, what's not great about being adored? I mean, you know, of course. I don't understand. But, oh, please no. I'm like, yeah, come on. I feel like that we share something, that we're extreme extroverts.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's tough for everybody. Don't get me wrong. I'm not discounting anybody's journey with this COVID shit, but for extreme extroverts, it's like, I am not a depressed person. I am not clinically depressed. I've never had that issue. Even when life was not good for me, I would have situational depression, but not clinical depression. This really got me down. So the writing, the structure, doing the Dellen Emerson show. I started teaching, you know, two master classes a week in, for acting.
Oh, which is great.
And then one writing class. And that's just 12 hours. But exactly what you said, you know, yes, I was giving of myself, but boy, was it feeding me right back. And
yeah,
gave me joy.
I was telling my mom yesterday, because again, you know, I'm quarantining with my parents in Boston, because I thought to myself, if something happens to them, at least somebody's there.
Right.
So, you know, it was fun. And I had to be sitting someplace. And so I figured, why not? But it's been over a year. And, you know, I'm like, I can't wait to get back to my apartment in LA. And my mom's like, oh, because it's been so hard being here. And I'm like, but you don't understand. Their lives have pretty much been what their lives are. But you and I are used to doing things and being out. I'm on planes 2 to 3 times a month. And being in one place has really been hard for me because I'm used to being on the go.
I get it. I mean, I miss packing that suitcase, man. I miss going through, you know, putting my finger on that, because I feel so privileged that I've, you know, I can get through TSA a lot quicker because I'm
like that.
I clear. And I went ahead. Oh. You know, they sent me the bill. I said, okay, I'm just going to pay it. I'm just living with hope in my heart. It's, you know, it's like,
have you been able to travel at all during this?
I traveled once. Okay. I traveled, you know, we fled Dallas after the
pandemic. Oh, you were already there, right?
In Dallas when it all happened. And I remember the day Emerson and I came back. We had just cast a very sordid wedding, and we had closed down this side of crazy, the rehearsals, and packed all of the props up and put them in storage there. And
that was a great production, by the way. The production was beautiful.
Thank
it was
you.
Very, it was a very efficient set, that which set, I'm always
I,
used
I was
to.
Like shocked he did not get nominated for an Ovation Award for that set. I mean,
well, Ovation.
They're gone. I was 0-6, Billy. I was nominated. Eight. I've had 8 nominations, no wins. So I'm never going to win an Ovation Award. Never.
That's fine. Then fuck them. So. Although it is sad, I have to say I'm not somebody who really wishes ill for people, because I always think that even if they're not recognizing me, the more theater and more performing arts that are out there, the better it is for everyone. So I'm always sad when anything shuts down.
I agree. I mean, I was surprised they didn't try to work it out, but you know, I don't know all of the details. And everybody kept saying, oh, there's a lot more. So I'm just going to go, okay, thank you for acknowledging and honoring. I mean, many of my actors won Ovation Awards over the years.
Oh, which is great.
We got many nominations. So I loved what they did for LA Theater. So I was really sad to see them go. Well, we got sidetracked on that.
Yeah.
But back to traveling. Yeah, I went, I had to really think long and hard about it. But last year, I go and teach in Natchitoches, which is still Magnolia's hometown. Every year and they asked me to come and teach in person. And I was like, oh my God, I don't know that I can do this. Teach acting and writing in person during a pandemic. And they were wonderful, but, in their safety. And, but you know, one of my students tested positive, you know, and,
really during the class,
during the class. Oh, and so suddenly I'm like freaking out, but I remained negative, thankfully, during the and got back home. But it was scary flying, you know. It was really scary. I was double masked, and you know, I even had plastic gloves that I would, you know, all the way up to, and then I would take them off and throw them away. I mean, lots of Purell. But
are you still doing all of that, or have you relaxed a little?
I'm vaccinated now.
Oh, good.
I keep telling people I got my shots. So I feel safer, but I'm still being respectful when I go out. I do mask, and but I don't wash. I don't alcohol my body when I come in. Like I would really, you know, I was worried.
Well, speaking of travel, what brought you from Texas to Los Angeles? Was it the acting career?
It was a dream, you know. I went to Baylor University, and the largest Baptist school in the world, and I got a degree in journalism and Spanish.
Hola.
Yes. ¿Cómo está? Guillermo. You would be Guillermo.
Yeah, oh, that's Guillermo, right. Master. I would be Guillermo, yes. Masteriori.
Yes. So my senior year, I mean, I just sort of abandoned acting in college. I thought, oh, my mother was, I don't think this is a good profession for you and your writing. And so I started really, you know, mining the journalism world. And my senior...
Had you worked as a journalist?
Not really. I mean, early in my career, I created an alter ego named John Altheimer, who was my publicist and got me all of the interviews early in my career before I could afford a real publicist. And
he
was
we have so much in common.
Oh my God. I mean, when they said, oh, Donald Trump used to do it, I said, well,
we all did it.
For that, I had letterhead. Anyway,
and voices and phone numbers. Oh, I know. I know.
The voices. He was very, yes, he was very. This is John Altheimer. How are you, Polly? Yeah, I call Polly Warfield. She would always give me articles on myself. So I admitted it at her memorial. I confessed the whole thing at the memorial. So the press releases that I worked, but my senior year of Baylor, I was one of the editors of the newspaper. I came out here to visit a good friend of mine, Beth Blackstock, who was getting her master's at Pepperdine, and she was living on the beach. And I came out, and literally her neighbor was Robert Redford, and her other neighbor was Joyce DeWitt. And I thought, I kind of like it out here. I think I want to, I'm going to take like a gap year to see if I want to act. So I didn't take a job, and I came out here, and it happened rather quickly. I really got into acting classes and found the right people to support me, and started working commercially as an actor. And just kind of by the time I was 26, my first play was produced.
Wow. And when did you sort of think to yourself, okay, this is what's working, so I'm going to really focus on this and put the acting on the back burner? Or did you try to do both?
I tried to do both for a while. I mean, a lot of people don't know this, but I was also a big voiceover agent when I first. I did a lot of looping work where it was ADR work. You would go in and replace voices in film and work for an amazing casting person named Barbara Harris. I still adore her. She gave me a lot of income. And so I tried to keep that going. It was weird because Daddy's Dying was running, and then Gary Goldberg came to see, Gary David Goldberg, who created Family Ties, came to see Daddy's Dying in the lobby. He said, would you come down to our level in TV and write an episode of Family Ties? And I was like, oh my God, yeah. And so he gave me my first opportunity. I literally turned in my first draft and we went on strike. Now, it was, again, one of those things where it was the best thing that happened to me because I was the newest member of the Writers Guild. Mm-hmm. And Steve Kometko, do you remember Steve Kometko?
Steve has been on this show twice.
Well, Steve Kometko did a feature on me, and they showed me marching, you know, with signs with the newest member of the Writers Guild. And they ended the interview on stage at Theater on the set of Daddy's Dying.
What great publicity is that?
Crazy. It was like we had already been running a year. We sold out for 6 months ahead. And because of that article, Norman Stevens and several people from different studios came to see the play. And by the time the strike was over, I had offers from three studios for overall deals. And Daddy's Dying, the movie, was in development at Propaganda Films.
And again, you cannot plan stuff like this. No. I mean, I think it shows really one thing we both have in common is that when an opportunity drops in your lap, as these things do, you have the ability to sort of take advantage of it and just see where it's going to go.
Yeah. So it was a no-brainer. I was you know, at that time I was still closeted. I was married to Kelly Alexander. We had a baby on the way, and I took the job. I took the jobs, and I don't regret any of it. I don't regret abandoning, you know, I gave up my agents. I had to
really
give up my acting agents, and then got, I never had a, it was weird. I mean, of course we struggle along the way, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I always say there is always a struggle, you know, 2006, big struggle, but I never had to work at being a writer. I just wrote and it just kind of happened. Whereas acting, I worked so hard. Oh my God, I got to get this agent. I got to get the showcase to these people and this. And it was much more of a struggle. So sometimes I think Deepak Chopra's law of least effort is absolutely appropriate for us.
Yeah, I think that I have been in that situation that writing sort of dropped in my lap because, I, like you, I was acting, I was doing stand-up, but I was always writing my own material. Someone needed a column within an hour and said, just bang out something that you would say. And who knew how valuable it was to be able to transfer your own voice to the written page? But I did it, and I kept doing it. And people said, do you realize how hard a skill that is to have? And I just like, yeah, I just do it. I never really valued it until I realized the things I'm valuing are a lot harder and aren't working out. And this thing that's so easy is bringing me a lot of success. Why aren't I focusing on that?
Mm. See, yeah, I could so relate to that because there was there was a period I thought, I don't know that I'm a good writer. It's so easy. I just don't understand why, you know, and then I, you know, as I started working more and realizing what writing was, and of course you know, you write what you know, and then when you don't, then you have to do a lot of research. And so I think, you know, you go back.
Do you like doing research?
I do like to research the psychology of a character. I have to understand it. I don't know if you saw my play, The Trials and Tribulations of a Trailer Trash Housewife. That
I did. Yep.
Beth Grant, Octavia Spencer, and Del Dickey, and Debbie Holiday, David Steen. I really had to understand her. I couldn't, and it was a big. It was like it was almost like being in college. I needed to understand domestic violence before I could really write about it because I had a story to tell. But I couldn't, I had to scratch deep into her psychology. And once that unlocked for me, I was able to write it. So yeah.
Do you still look back and think to yourself, oh, I've learned more and there's some stuff that I didn't know when I wrote that?
Oh, there were, you know, when I look back at Daddy's Dying, Who's Got the Will, and thinking about how easy it came to me and how little I had to do of research, because all I did was steal my family. I mean, I just literally.
But do you know how hard that is? That most people can't just do that. That is a skill.
There's a lot of fear involved with most people. I was just so silly that I thought, oh, my family never goes to the theater. My mother will come out and see it, but the rest of them won't even know about it. And then the movie.
A movie.
And I am fucked. I mean, I had one aunt that didn't speak to me for 7 years. She was just livid.
That hard? Because I have written things and I've done stand-up where obviously as stand-ups, we know you use your own material and it's, I very often will shift things, but you know that a family member who sees it's going to see right through that. And that can, that self-censoring can really inhibit your creativity.
Well, yes, of course. And I'm not going to lie. My heart did flutter, you know, when I finally ran into some of them and I was like, oh, fuck. But I mean, I can't imagine. Let me turn the tables a little bit. What do you do when you like, you know, you go after somebody in one of your columns and then you run into them at an event? I mean, what's that like?
Well, I mean, you know, I have not always been completely supportive of everything you've done. There have been things that, you know, I haven't. Well, I mean, we can talk very briefly about your marriage, that there was a lot of criticism at the time because you were one of the first and you were so high profile that I feel now looking back that I don't know how it could have survived because I think there had to have been a lot of pressure and people like me, we're like, oh, this older guy and this young hot guy, oh, that's never going to last. How does that, I mean, I don't ask people usually because I think most people are above all of that. But then when I've been criticized, I'm not really above it. It does get to me. So how did that make you feel? Because did you feel that pressure?
Well, of course. I mean, especially with the divorce, I felt.
Oh, that's going to be even worse.
The things that I read were hurtful and
horrible.
And I just had to stop, and I had to take care of myself because I was an emotional wreck, you know, at the end of, you know, with
how long were you together?
We were together almost 10 years.
Well, that's a long time.
Yeah, it's a very long time. So yeah, that was new to me, honestly. I mean, because, you know, social media had just started being crazy and blogs and stuff. But then suddenly you read, you know, Del Shores and Jason Dolly are divorcing, and then you see all the comments. And
Do you read comments?
I do sometimes read comments, but with that particular situation, I had to make myself turn it off because otherwise, I would have just gone nuts. I mean, I was already nuts, but I read some things, and I don't think I've ever said to you or to anybody that wrote anything negative about me. I have gone after one critic
that was really
cruel to young actors in one of my plays in Dallas.
So it's being defensive of them, defending them.
I can take it. You can do whatever you want to me, but don't go after the kids. Don't go after the kids in my play. And they were quite brilliant. And I just wrote a really nasty letter to her that started with, did you just have a bad childhood? Did your parents not love you? Did you go through an awful, awful marriage? Or did someone jilt you? Why are you so fucking unhappy? And, you know, we got into it. I mean, we got into it back and forth. But that also taught me a lesson. You know what? They're words. They're somebody else's opinion of you. And I was telling, you know, when we lost, we were recently with the Back to the Ovations. We were nominated for 6 Ovation Awards. And I, in my mind, I was going, how can anybody beat my cast for ensemble? They were so fucking good. And the next day after we lost all 6 of them, I wrote the cast and I said, you know what? We had a story to tell. And we told our story.
And that's what it's about.
And that's what it's really about. And people responded to that story. And that, you know, you look on Rotten Tomatoes. If you go to Rotten Tomatoes right now, you will look at all my body of work. You go to my most famous work. And it is the worst reviewed movie of my career. But yet the audience is like 87%. But the critics are like 32%. And I think I'd rather have the audience.
Yeah, I am. You know, you mentioned going to the defense of other people. And I'm thinking to myself, I was in a, right after the original Queer Eye for the Straight Guy came out, the first cast, I was at a restaurant in New York. And I don't remember what it was about, but I remember something had come out about one of the guys. And, you know, I reported it as I would. And I'm sure I was somewhat catty. And Carson Kressley was in the same restaurant. We didn't know each other at the time. And he came over to me, and I don't remember which guy it was. It might have been Jay or somebody who I've become friends with since, who said to me, I know you've got to write what you've got to write, but, you know, if you want to come after someone on the show, come after me because I can take it. It's a fair fight. And I thought to myself, you know, it gave me such respect for him because I thought, first off, I think he's recognizing that there's no such thing as bad publicity. So he's like, write more about me. But he's also being very protective of somebody who maybe he knew was having a hard time with this and really doesn't have the voice yet to stand up to somebody like me, who the hell am I? But so I really, and it did change something because I thought to myself, you know, it made me look at Carson in a different light. Right. So it did shift my opinion. And I thought, and it also made me respect anybody who can come up to me.
You know, Carson was in Sorted Lives, the series. He was one of the therapists. And he did such a sweet thing for us last year, because early pandemic, we, you know, all these theaters were suffering, and I have a foundation now, the Del Shores Foundation. And we supported 23 nonprofits by having, we got most of all the cast back together from the movie Sorted Lives, of sort of a blend of the movie and the series and the plays. Yeah. And we raised over $80,000 for the theater.
That's great.
And Carson gave a PSA right on, you know, and he was so generous. I reached out to him and he said yes like that. So he's good man.
But, yeah, I have found that people, you know, I think that those of us who have been around for a while, we all do kind of know each other and have these relationships. And even if you don't know each other very well, we are part of this little enclave that we get it, and that you all sort of have this shared experience that whether you're close or not, you still, it's like extended family almost.
It absolutely is. But back to the topic we were talking about, you know, I think you have to develop a little bit of a thick skin, don't you? You know, to be in this business. I mean, especially if you're going to put your work out there, you're going to get the reviews, and you're going to get bad reviews. There's just no way you're not. I mean, nobody gets 100% great reviews. And every now and then, if you look, let's be honest, you and I both have mouths. And if you have a mouth like we do, we're going to get some backlash sometime. And you just have to figure that out. I go, okay, I can take it. But the reason
Has there been anything that came up that you thought up, I made a misstep?
That I made a misstep?
Yeah. Yeah.
In my career?
Well, career or even personally, that you felt you're getting this criticism, you're like, oh, I shouldn't have done that.
I have to admit, you know, I've never admitted this publicly, but early in my, you know, in some of my stand-up, I thought, you know, as stand-up comedians, anything kind of goes. And I sort of regret my compassion for homeless folks here, especially in my neighborhood, and the epidemic that it has become. I was pretty, I had some funny stuff, but in hindsight, I don't find it so funny. And, the little people, I used a word in my act that I got kind of chastised from. And I wish I had that one over. I wish I had listened. So you know, with what's going on in the country with the Black Lives Matter movement and just the fact that we need the Me Too movement, I feel like that we do all have to listen. We must listen to what is going on. We must listen to other voices. And we can't just say, oh, come on, I was just being funny. Well, yeah, I was being funny, but maybe I hurt some people.
But I think by also being a storyteller, I think that your talent can be used exponentially for good in the way that you put a spotlight on those stories. So that's yes, right. There may be some missteps, but I think the pros far outweigh the cons.
I do too. And I thank you for that, because I mean, I think about all the positive letters that I have, you know, with Southern Baptist Sissies, just the religious damage that has happened to so many of our LGBTQ plus community, and for them to see Southern Baptist Sissies and to feel that they're not alone. And I mean, I got a letter this week. It's amazing that after all these years, people are still responding to that piece. Or I came out because of the Ty and Latrell scene in Sorted Lives. I had a guy I literally flew back to Oklahoma after I saw your play. This was before the movie, because I thought, if you can do it with humor, I can face my family. And it came up to me in Borders bookstore. And
gives you a huge responsibility too.
And it's kind of humbling, because honestly, I don't write to, you know, it's not like, oh, I got this message. I got to tell, you know, I've got to get, you know, with like Blues for Willadine, Trailer Trash Housewife, I had a woman write me and she said, I left my husband because of your movie. I saw myself in Willadine and I could not be that person anymore for my kids. I had to get out. And but I don't write for those. I write mainly just to entertain. You know, I write to for laughter, for and sometimes.
But is there also an education? Because it seems to me that you're a very smart writer and that there is a message in most of your work. So is that conscious or is that just part of your storytelling process?
It's interesting. I did this interview where they talked about the social issues within my plays. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that early on, especially, I wasn't going, oh, I need to write about this. I need to write about this. It just happened to be the story that I told at the time. I didn't go, I need to tackle domestic violence. The reason I wrote Trailer Trash Housewife was because one of my boyfriend's sister was in a domestic violence relationship and it ended horribly and she became an activist. And I was so inspired by her that I wanted to write about a woman, you know.
But did you want to write about her to share her story or to shine a light on it for other people?
To shine a light, not to tell her exact story, but right. to shine.
So that is educating. You really are an educator.
I guess so. Yeah, somewhat. You don't want to be like, oh my God, it was so didactic. I mean, beat it over the head. So so then you add Peanut and Odette to Southern Baptist Sissy. So there'll be, you know.
So the entertainment really is the driving force. You may have the story, but it's got to be married together.
Look, I've said it many times. I go, I write mainly so you will laugh. But if I can make you think and if I can make you cry just a little bit, I'm okay with that too. And and then I get to write, you know. By the way, I just saw his book sitting over there. I read yesterday, I had a little issue with the IRS and I was on hold trying to get this answer for 2 hours and 57 minutes. And I read Leslie Jordan's entire book while I waited. It's good.
Great.
It's so good.
I was telling you when we were texting and I said, how great. I mean, I am like the envy of gay boys that I had gone away from my computer for 2 hours to do a Zoom meeting and came back and had emails from Dell and Leslie within those 2 hours.
Oh my God.
And I said, see, this is, you know, there are parts of my life that I go, you know, it's not the parts that people know. It's not the parts that I broadcast, but it's the parts I go, oh, this is just such a fabulous life. And anytime I'm traveling, I will run into Leslie. He'll be doing a personal appearance or a book signing. And he'll say to me, Billy, you just show up in the strangest places. And I say, I see Leslie's name someplace and I'm there. If I can be.
Isn't it wonderful to see? I mean, talk about, you know, pandemic success. Who would have thought?
Oh, he puts us all to shame. No, he was texting me and he's like, I'm not doing any shows until I hear if Cat is renewed. So yeah. Everything is on hold right now. And we're keeping our fingers crossed for Call Me Cat.
Yeah,
but yeah, a CD, a book, the Instagram, the radio show. I mean, a series. He's busier than all of us put together.
He's busy. I'm lucky he answers my text messages.
He always refers to you as his brother because he always says to me, you know, Dell and I like are from the same womb.
We are. We are very, I always, you know, the one thing about actors like Leslie and Ann Walker and Dell Dickey and Beth Grant is I never had to direct them much because they heard what I heard. You know, they just heard that the same voice. And
it seems to me you have a little troupe, a little repertory troupe. Do you write with their voices in your head?
I do. I wrote the play that you saw. I wrote with the three sisters. I didn't know who the mother was going to be. Diddy Blaylock. But Bobby Weeks, I wrote that role for her. Dell Dickey, who's been my muse for many, many years. I mean, that was our 18th time to work together, Dell and I. And then Rachel Sorsa, who I adore. She was one of the Kates in Yellow, my play Yellow. Once I find an actor that sings my song, it just makes my job easier.
When you write and you hear their voice in your head, because I have done this as well, and then it may not.
I'm so sorry. Do you hear my dog?
Hi, honey.
That's the they match the siren.
The sirens. I heard the siren earlier.
Itzy, stop it! That's so annoying.
That's
she's out the window howling.
when you write something with somebody's voice in your head and somebody else plays the part, how do you react to that?
I'm so sorry. They're distracting me.
That's all right. You do that. You deal.
Stop it. So you're asking me if I write with someone.
Have you written something with somebody's voice in your mind and someone else had to play that part?
Sometimes.
Do you shift it?
I don't always, but and sometimes I'm pleasantly surprised that it works as well or sometimes even better than what I had.
Really?
Yeah. Every now and then it's like. It's almost a cheat. I mean, you're a writer. It's almost a cheat when you hear the voice. You can hear the cadence. You can hear. I mean, you know,
it's
when
music,
I hear,
right?
You hear Leslie's voice right now. You know, just right. Exactly the way he would say something. It just makes it the dialogue just pour. You know, just pour out of you. And then if another actor, I mean, you know, look at Sordid Lives. It's been produced.
So how many actors, right?
How many actors have played Sissy? How many actors have played? And, you know, not all of them great, but many of them wonderful.
Yeah, so. I find it interesting that when I see your plays in particular, it seems to me that the roles are written for people, even when I've seen replacements, which I think is a talent that not everybody has. And I don't know if I should give the credit to you as the writer or you as the director or the actor.
It's a collaboration. It really is. I feel like that. I don't understand. You know, I don't understand, Billy, when I hear like, directors go, oh, I hate actors. And I go, you wouldn't have a job if you
didn't. Yeah, why are you doing this?
Or writers, oh, actors. I'm going, please, I adore actors because actors are what brings it all to life for me. And
good actors.
Yeah, really good actors. Yeah.
What do you learn from bad actors?
Not to cast them.
But do bad actors tell you something about your work, either good or bad?
I don't ever think like that. I always think if I see a bad actor say my words, I'm just going, thank God. Thank God I had the history of this play to have seen, you know, to see Ann Walker playing LaVonda instead of this person. Because I know it works. I know.
Any of your plays actor proof?
I don't think that any play is actor proof. I really don't. I don't. I mean, I think Sordid Lives is the closest because people always know the lines. You know, that you do the play, it's so similar to the film. And the audience, I always tell actors, I go, you better know your lines. When you do Sordid Lives, you better know your lines because the audience is going to know your lines. And I feel like just because of the cult status of the film, it's the closest to being actor proof. But I don't think anything. I mean, Jesus, how many times have we seen a bad Tennessee Williams production? Yeah, you know, Cat on a
High. More times than I would like to remember.
So. That's right. Not everybody should be playing Stella. Not everybody should be playing Blanche.
Yeah, and it's funny because you talked about the Southern tradition. And one of the things that I've seen you many times at Trevor Project benefits, and it seems to me from what I read, the feedback of Southern people, that your works have really helped kids who were coming out, who were contemplating suicide and really thinking they were alone or they had no voice. And your works have really given them hope and made them feel less alone.
Yeah, and I love that organization. Yeah, we've been there a lot of times for their event. I haven't been as active in their in the organization, but I'm always supportive. But there was a time where I remember when I was on when we were doing Queer as Folk. I got there. It was right after the fifth season. I got the entire many of the cast to do a PSA for the Trevor Project that they played, and then I directed backstage all the PSAs for all the celebrities, and many, many celebrities came back and supported that. But yeah, that's you know, when someone comes up to you and says, "Hey, it saved my life." You know, right. With Southern Baptist Sissies, that's happened a couple of times where someone said, "I saw your play and it saved my life." So, it's, you know, those are the real rewards. Truly.
Not, yes, we haven't really talked that much about Sordid Lives, but Sordid Lives, apparently it's the 20th anniversary. Is that true?
Yes. Well, it was.
Oh my God.
It's now the 21st.
Oh yeah. Right. 2020. Of course. But it seems to me, and again, I've been in LA now for 23 years. So I remember it was funny because it started as this little underground thing that just you kept hearing about and people kept talking about. And it was, for me at least, on the outside, I kept hearing about it through word of mouth more than print.
Right.
And was that your experience?
Well, yeah. You're talking about the film, right? When the film
right.
started.
Yeah.
And you know what happened, Billy, is that the film, it sort of just lay there in a lot of cities. It was released and it played for a couple of weeks. And then all of a sudden, it was Palm Springs. Palm Springs at the Camelot Theater. It played for 96 weeks. And because Palm Springs...
wait, hold on. 96 weeks? So that's almost 2 years.
Yes, yes.
That's madness.
It was crazy. It was crazy. The domestic gross of Sordid Lives... more than half was at the Camelot theaters.
It was Palm Springs.
In Palm Springs. It just never would stop. And so because of that, and because people go to Palm Springs.
Right.
They were like sharing it. Oh, you got it. So when the DVD came out, it's like what we say now, it went viral. Well, the DVD kind of went viral. And, you know, it sold... just an amazing amount of copies back when nobody was streaming back then.
Right. There was no such thing. Was it on like pay channels? Like, was it on HBO or Showtime or anything?
It never was on HBO. It was never, now since then it's been on Netflix and it's been on Hulu and it's been on.
So it really grew word of mouth and actual DVD sales or rentals.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is shocking.
It was just a little miracle. I mean, you know, to this day, I mean, I don't think I can write anything that will ever surpass it where people will, I'll always be that guy. And I'm okay with that. I'm going, okay.
Well, please, there are worse things to be known for. But did you think that that was going to be the work that was going to catapult you up? Was that, did you know that would be the one?
No clue. I mean, the first time we had an inkling was we heard that they were celebrating, I think it was the year anniversary at the Camelot theaters. And they said, we want to do a big, big party. So will you all come down? So we went down a couple of times and I sometimes blend them, you know, I'm not
sure, right. Of course.
But I'm almost sure that was the one where Olivia Newton-John got us this bus, you know, like a big tour bus kind of thing. And we all went down there and we were all in this, the whole cast. And when we walked out of that bus and we saw this, just this sea of people waiting and dressed like Brother Boy and dressed like Bitsy May and dressed like Aunt Sissy and all of them, they had, you know, rubber bands popping their arms. And there was this lug nut club where they, you know, where they would get the lug nut every time they saw the movie. And then we saw the movie with them and they sold out all three screenings there. And people were screaming out the lines. And I was like, this is like something I didn't know. I didn't know that this is what it had become.
And the funny thing was I had talked to Olivia about this and she really, I guess it was her sister who had brought the idea to her, but she really went after this. She just wasn't sure she could do the accent.
That's right.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's exactly right. She had said to me jokingly, she called me one, we'd become friends because Rona, her sister, was one of my very best friends. Before she passed away. And Rona had brought her to see Sordid Lives. And she jokingly said, she said, well, if you ever do a movie, I wanted you to, you know, that singer. And I said, I'm going to hold you to that. And so one day she called, it was my birthday, and she called me to wish me a happy birthday. And I said, I'm doing the film version of this. Will you do Bitsy May? And she said, oh my God, let me think about it. And so she called me the next day and she said, come out and let's talk about it. And I went out to her place in Malibu, and Mark Hartley, her manager, came down and he said, you should do it. You should do this.
And is it true she did it for scale?
She did it. I think Olivia maybe made less than $1,000 for that piece of work she did. I mean, everybody did it for the love of the project. Everybody, Bo Bridges, everybody, we all worked for scale. And yes, she did not, the way she learned the accent was Ann Walker tape recorded all of her lines. And while she was on tour, she would listen to them every single day. So that's how she got the accent.
Oh, and again, also to do the series. And what's interesting about the series, and people who may not remember this, is that really the Sorted Lives series did put Logo on the map. Yeah. Logo really had crap. I can say that. And did they come to you for Sorted Lives or did you go to them? But whoever did it, it was the reason people watched Logo.
Yeah. I mean, the evolution of the series, you know, I told you about that novel that I had been writing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I have to, you know, even though the marriage did not continue, Jason was the one who said, I think you have a series here. And he said, you've got such a brand with this. It's such a brand. So I called my agent and I said, would you set me up a meeting with Dave Mace over at Logo? Mm-hmm. And I went in and it just so happened that he was a big fan of the movie. And he said, yes. He said,
so you didn't have to sell him.
I didn't have to sell him. And he said, let's do it. And so he took it to Brian Graydon and they said, yes. And then it took a long time. It took at least a year for us to just get the financing because Logo didn't have that much money. And we had to bring in IMG and, you know, it was a big pot of money coming from all different sources. And then of course the demise of the series was because.
Was
the,
also money.
Yeah, the producer didn't pay us our residual.
Did you ever get that? Because I remember all that scandal and then he went bankrupt and like,
yeah, I never went bankrupt. I never.
No, not you, the producer that supposed to pay you.
But I lost everything. I was just grasping.
Well, I remember you lost your house. Is that right?
I did lose my house during this time.
You know, I don't know the timing of this, but did all that drama contribute to the marriage difficulties? Because that's going to be a lot to be hitting.
I don't think it helped. But you know, I'm trying very much in my old age to celebrate the positive of everything.
Yeah. Well, I'd heard that you and Jason are now friendly.
We're friendly, yes. The positive of that experience, and again, giving him some credit for it, is he's the one who said, because I was locked. I was locked to a contract to somebody who was not paying me. And no, we never got our money. We went bankrupt and we had a settlement of $2.7 million of residuals.
Right. I remember that.
Collectively. And we got a fraction of it in the bankruptcy settlement years later. But it's the reason I started standing on stage and talking shit. You know?
Well, you also started doing that tour. And also a lot of friends came to your support and like people would drop in. And when did you do that tour that like people would come together? I know Rue was doing it with you for a while. Yeah. And I think didn't Delta do it at one point?
Delta doing the national tour of Southern Baptist Theses and Sorted Lives preceded the series.
Okay.
After the series was while the series was in limbo, while we were waiting to see if we could, because Logo did order a second season.
I thought so.
But we couldn't do it. And I wrote, you know, 8 episodes of that second season.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I did. I mean, I'll send you copies. You can read them.
I'd love to read them.
But there, we went on the road. Yeah, we went.
And your, you know, again, you know, speaking to you as a person, your cast has been extremely loyal. All your casts, you know, of all your things, people are very loyal to you. You're loyal to them because you write them great parts, but they also come out for you. I remember when the series premiered, I was at a party in New York. I think it might have been the New York release, and I think it might have been for the Trevor Project or something.
It was. It was.
Okay. And I remember Olivia flew out because I remember Michael Caprio. We're all friends. And so I'm like, these people, they don't have to do this. And they usually don't. But they're doing this for you and for the project. And that's very rare.
Yeah. That's that. It's just a... It is really a love fest. I mean, we all feel like we're one big family. We're, you know, I socialize with all of them, and it's just been a good ride. My sort
Do you want to write a sequel? Because since you wrote a second season, is there an idea of a sequel play?
Well, there was a very sordid wedding, and that felt for me, that was the end of it.
Really?
It ended with these weddings, and they ended celebrating, you know, marriage equality. And it just felt like a nice little bow. On the franchise. So I'm going to do, you know, the book, I did return to the book, and there is the novel that's coming out, but that returns to the characters, but I don't think there's any more in there. I have more stories to tell, but I don't feel that it is in the sordid world.
So let's go to your personal life. Where are you now as a gay man who is successful, who's busy, who has a million irons in the fire? How do you look at your life as just a person?
Well, I feel like I'm happy. I'm single. I don't.
Are you happy being single?
Most days.
do you have a sex life?
Oh my goodness. Well, during the pandemic,
because I'm single, but I have a very good sex life.
Well, good for you.
Not
much of, not much, especially during the pandemic. It has not been.
Well, yeah, that's been hard.
That's been tough. I do take that blue pill, not the Viagra one. I don't need that, but I take the Descovy and I go.
I do too.
I look at it and I go, well, I'm just living with hope in my heart that when this is all over, there will be, some activity. But as far as relationships, I don't know that that's ever going to be a part of my life again. I just don't know. The pursuit is awfully exhausting.
Yeah.
You know,
is that because of your success? Is that because of your age, or is that because of your previous experiences, or maybe a combination?
It's probably a combination of more the last two.
Really?
Yeah, I would.
Do you have to worry why people are interested in you? I mean, you're so successful, you're so visible in the gay community. Everybody knows you.
You're like getting to the shit.
Well, you know, no, I mean, you know, because I know. Let me just say this. I don't mind saying this. I sleep with people who I would never have a shot with if I weren't Billy Masters. Mm. So I embrace that as far as I'm concerned, but I wouldn't date those people. You know, I sleep with the porn stars and the strippers and the hookers. I wouldn't marry them. I know the difference, but it's made me a little cynical about relationships because you do have to question why, how does this work out? Where is this going?
Yeah, I guess there's always a little bit of that where you go, you know, that's why I honestly, if someone doesn't know who I am and they're interested in me, it means so much more.
Oh, yes.
It's like and that's happened, you know, a few times. And I love that. Yeah.
Like dating?
I do like dating. I
do too.
Dating. I don't love the pursuit of dating. I don't love going on OkCupid and perusing and trying to, and you know, and the ageism in our community is rather intense, and it slams your self-esteem, you know. Any breakup slam. I mean, that slammed my self-esteem. It really. I'll be honest, it did.
But are you more attracted to guys who are younger?
No, not necessarily.
Okay, so it's not. Jason is not the type. There's a wide range.
Not at all.
Because I've had gay people on the show who have said, and it's very interesting that I could be very interested in people my age. People my age who are single want people younger than them. And I find that a lot. And there is this pursuit of youth and beauty, which I wholeheartedly endorse. But I don't know if that leads to stability or a relationship, if that's what you want.
Right. No, I get you. That you know, it's like it gets very complicated. Let's just say you start playing a lot of head games with yourself. And
yeah.
But the good thing is, happiness for me is a lot of friendships. I have two amazing daughters, so I have a great family, and I have these three little bitches that run around. So I don't feel lonely, you know.
How old are your daughters?
My daughters, Rebecca is 31 now, and my daughter.
Oh my God! In merciful heaven.
28. My daughter Caroline is 28, and they're both amazing humans. My daughter Caroline works with autistic kids up in San Francisco.
Oh, great!
The caretaker for an autistic child, and then Rebecca is a school teacher. She just went back to work in the classroom.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself bisexual or do you consider yourself gay?
Gay.
Did you ever consider yourself bisexual?
Of course, you go through that. You go, I'm straight, but you know, there's some bisexual, and then you go, oh, I'm bi. And here's why I had a lot of therapy, Billy, and I remember this wonderful therapist, Dr. Sandra Baca. I kept, after my marriage was over with my ex-wife, I kept defining myself as bi. And she said, you know, about 6 months after, she said, let me ask you a question, Del. Since you've given yourself permission to be with men, mm-hmm. how many women have you slept with? And I said, okay, I'm gay.
Was that a hard process for you to actually define yourself as gay?
Once I did, it just felt so right. You know,
really?
it was just that, you know, I mean, everybody says, well, oh my God, it took you. So I was 35 years old, but just watch Southern Baptist Sissies. I was really fucked up. I was very damaged, and religion played a big part in that.
You know, we are getting 9 million texts and most of them are from somebody named Nisi May. So Nisi, hello. Oh, I'm just looking to see. Well, now, see, she says you're not bisexual. You're blessed.
Oh, okay.
All right. But send money. Let's talk about the foundation. You know, we've talked about everything except for the foundation. Yeah, when did you start it?
We started it just probably about 6 or 7 months before the pandemic hit.
It's really recent.
It was really recent. And we had so my good friend Stuart Bell came up with the idea, and Emerson Collins is a big part of it. And we just hired our first executive director, Allison Bergman. And the foundation is basically a mentoring program for LGBTQ Southern writers, storytellers, mm-hmm. and we help them get their stories told.
What has response been like? Have you gotten like these incredible pieces that you've read?
Not yet. Okay. We're just starting on that journey. We were launching everything, and with all the events, we have a big contest every year, or are we going to where mm-hmm. it's a playwright?
Oh, so like a competition, right?
Film and screenplay. And everything just came to a screeching halt. But we are just now rebooting everything. So soon we will be reading a lot of stories, a lot of people's work.
And you have been supporting a lot of small theaters.
Yes.
And they're real. Are they all under 99 seat?
Not all of them. No, I mean, because New Conservatory is part of that.
Oh, are they part of it?
Okay. Uptown Players is part of that. They're all our partners. And when we really conceived of the foundation, we reached out to film festivals and theaters, and they were going to be our partners for us to facilitate us getting our our films to them so that they would read them and help us with the competition.
And maybe present them and do readings and whatever. And
we were going to give grants to theaters to produce the winning.
Yeah.
And then when the pandemic happened and our partners got in trouble, we decided to flip it and allow the foundation to help them. And that's
great.
That's why we raised the money. And because of that, we're going to do that every year. We're going to have one event a year where we help our theaters, our partners.
Oh, which is so you can do both, which is so important. Right. I'm really curious about producing because you've really taken the reins and produced a lot of your own things. And do you like the production side of the work?
I like having people like Emerson Collins, who is very good at the producing. I don't mind producing. Right. I don't. I would rather write and direct. Writer director, but it's part of it, and I'm good at it. But part of the way I am good at it is I surround myself with really good people. So I've had great line producers. I've had amazing. Emerson has been such a great partner of mine since 2006. So I've had a lot of good producing partners. And Louise Beard, who is part of we have a company called Beard Collins Shores, and we have done many projects together. But the raising of the money, I do not love it. I do not love it.
Have you put your own money into your projects?
I put my money into one. Well, more than one plays, but not the films.
No. Did you get that money back?
Well, I'll just tell you the play I financed was Sordid Lives. So yes.
Yeah. Oh, you're no fool. Okay, you held on to that one.
No. But
is there a play you would put money in? Like, are you somebody who's willing to put yourself on the line financially?
I have. I've invested in other people's plays.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Years ago, a play called Ballad that Ann Walker starred in. I
remember that.
Helped with that one. And I mean, I don't have the kind of money that I could invest in Broadway, but I would, but anytime that there's a passion project, anybody has an Indiegogo or a GoFundMe for their little film, I always feel that I need to.
Well, I think we've been so fortunate. You know, I have not had the success that you have had, but I think but I'm not somebody who looks at what I don't have. I very often sit back and say, oh my God, I am the luckiest person in the world because I get to support myself doing something I love, seeing plays, which I would do anyway, talking to people I'm interested in, doing research. So I don't know if there's things, you know, you talked about if you could change something, there's that cascading effect. And I'm very wary about the idea that if I had changed one thing, what the damage could have been. Is there anything like that in your life that you look at and say, oh, I have just been so lucky?
I feel like that my whole career has been just one stroke of luck after another. And I want to say something to you. You said that you said, I haven't had the success yet. You have. Yeah. You've had your success. It's
right.
It's apples and oranges. It's different. We have, you know, I can't say, well, I haven't had the success of Ryan Murphy or whatever. He had his path. I have my path. You have your lane.
And who knows if he's as happy as you are or as I am.
Who knows anything? But I have, I don't have those regrets with my career. I feel like that, I probably could have made some different choices, some better choices along the way. But I'm content. I like my body of work. And I don't know how. Do you ever think of retiring? People keep saying, "Oh, you're going to retire." I don't even know how.
No, because you know, it's funny. I have a friend who's probably watching this. Hi, Freddie. Who is so happy to just sit home and watch crap on TV and eat chips, and I think to myself, I love always moving. Everything I do for work I would do for free. And I think that is, you know, that is why I consider myself a success, because I'm doing what I love.
That's
and I'm living the way I want to live.
Yeah, see, so, you just said it. Work for, when someone says, oh, you work so hard, I said, no, I play a lot.
Yeah. And I think to myself, I'm not digging ditches. I'm not like working in an office typing. And when I am sitting in an office typing, it's for my own projects. So who could complain about that?
There you go.
Is there anything on your bucket list? Like, is there something you say, someday I'm going to do this?
Someday I would like to work with Holly Hunter. Someday I would like to work with Sissy Spacek. Someday, you know, there's a travel. There's a lot of travel that I haven't done, you know.
Has most of your travel been work-related?
A lot of it. Yeah. A lot of it. I've gotten to, you know, because when I was doing a lot of cruises and performing on cruises, it was wonderful to be able to go to all these countries I hadn't been to before. But there's a lot of places I would like to go to. You know, it's like the other day, someone invited me to Puerto Vallarta, and I immediately thought, well, should I do a couple of shows down there? And then I thought, you know what?
God, that is how I'm wired, too. Like, let's combine it.
I told myself, you've got to stop doing that. You've got to go and just enjoy. Now that
but
this-
can you, like, when I'm sitting on a beach, I go down to Provincetown quite a bit because I usually spend the summers in Boston. And when I'm down there, I'm always writing something or I have an idea that when you work for yourself, I don't know when you turn that off.
It's hard. I'm playing P-Town, by the way. That's the first.
Oh, are you?
The first gig I'm going to do is with Debbie Holiday. We're going to both go and do play the post office.
Oh my God. I can't wait. When do you know when?
We're still in the throes of getting all the dates, but it looks like it's going to be like the last couple of days of June and the first week of July.
Oh, then I will definitely come down and see you guys. And Debbie is one of my dearest. I love Debbie so much.
Oh, there's some talent.
Oh, well, let me just say, I have loved this because these are questions. It is a conversation that I've wanted to have with you for so long. And it's funny because every once in a while, I will sit down with somebody like in a coffee shop and they will say to me, you know, I kind of feel like you're interviewing me. And I'm like, but I'm an innately curious person. And when I do this, I feel like I'm sitting with you in a coffee shop. I really do.
I know. You made me a little uncomfortable there for a second. I thought, okay, it's just us.
You got to ride it out. No, I know. You know, it's funny because I thought to myself, I had so much I wanted to ask you. And there's one thing to sit down in a coffee shop and talk about it. It's another thing to do it publicly. But I think that what you have accomplished and really what you've given, specifically the gay community, is you've given people a lot of hope, a lot of entertainment, and a lot of things to reflect upon. And I don't know if there's anything better than that. I just make them laugh, but, you know, that's fine.
That's very valid, especially these days. So thank you for those laughs.
Oh, you know, and thank you for everything you've done.
I did.
This was really so much fun. And really, when I get back to LA, it's something I would like to do. I'd like to spend more time with you because you're so fat. And, you know, there are very few people who live the lives we live. And I think we're fortunate, but I think we also get caught up in our own lane that we kind of miss that there are other people in that same lane. We're not alone. We have so many people who are traveling that same road.
Yeah.
You know, and you're lucky you've got collaborators. You're so fortunate.
I feel very fortunate. So.
And you know that Emerson ain't so bad to look at either.
Not at all.
Just mention that.
And then Blake, they're like my little brothers, though. Like
no, I had Emerson, Blake, and Scott on like one of the first shows, like the first couple months. Can I just say the three of them together, they were the biggest live numbers we ever had. Like people were dropping everything to watch them together. And they said, you know, I really feel like I'm spending time eavesdropping on friends. And that's, you know, what is better than
friends.
That?
They're very good friends. So, and
well, they were living together at the time.
So like together now and have been for many years. So, yeah. But thank you again for having me.
This has been so much fun. Del, thank you. What's the website?
DelShores.com.
And then the foundation.
The foundation is DelShoresFoundation.org.
See? That's when you know it's serious, when you have a dog. Dell, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. It's been great getting to know you. It's like a first date, kind of.
All right. I will see you. Maybe I'll see you in P-Town.
I hope so. Take care, Dell. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye. Guys, thank you for watching Billy Masters Live. Next week might be Norm Corby. It might be Eric Nies. Who knows? It's not going to be Tempest Storm. That's all I know. Now, my friends will tell me, oh, my God, wait, I got another comment. What is this? Oh, my God, it's Niecy again. Okay, so there's a button right here. I can't see it, but you can see it. And it's if you're on YouTube, it says subscribe. And my friend Kenny will tell me you've got to ring the bell. I don't know what happens. Every time you ring your bell, I'll have sex with another hot guy. So ring those bells. Thank you for watching. I have been Billy Masters. This has been Billy Masters Live. And just remember, if we're here, we're live. Have a great weekend. Bye, guys.